Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host a Courthouse Steps decision on Mahmoud v. Taylor, featuring Eric Baxter. Eric is Vice President and Senior Counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, where he's represented religious organizations and individuals in a wide array of religious liberty disputes. He frequently appears on national media to discuss religious liberty issues and has written op-eds in many major newspaper publications. Before joining the Beckett Fund, Eric was a partner at Arndt Fox LLP, and he also served for many years as outside counsel to a DC church and its affiliated school. He argued Mahmoud before the Supreme Court, so we are delighted to have him with us for this program. Our moderator for today's discussion is Professor Teresa Stanton Collette. Professor Collette is a professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where she serves as director of the school's pro-life center. She received her doctorate from the University of Oklahoma College of Law. A prolific scholar, Professor Collette has published numerous legal articles and co-authored books on professional responsibility and Catholic perspectives on American law. She is an elected member of the American Law Institute and has testified before committees of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives. Notably, she also served on the Pontifical Council for the Family under Pope Benedict and Pope Francis. Professor Collette has also represented government officials and medical groups in significant legal cases concerning abortion and parental rights for the U.S. Supreme Court and federal appellate courts. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Professor Collette, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
I'm absolutely delighted, and I'd like to start off by thanking everyone who is watching this podcast. We think it's a really important case, and I appreciate the fact that you're taking time with such quick notice to join us today. Eric, I still remember that when we were talking about this case right after the oral argument, you mentioned this is your first case before the United States Supreme Court. Not bad for a maiden voyage. Well done, sir.
Thank you. It was a great case and really honored to stand on the shoulders of giants before me, including the parents who had the courage to bring this case and the whole team here at Beckett that really made it happen. So thank you.
What do you think are perhaps the top two or three aspects of the majority ruling, Justice Alito's ruling, that will impact religious liberty going forward, separate and independent of education or within the context of education? Either way, what are the three takeaways for our audience?
Yeah, I think one of the big things is the revival of Yoder as a precedent, a bedrock free exercise precedent by the court. Yoder was decided in 1972. Since then, nearly every case where parents have brought kind of an opt-out request to the courts, they've been denied. And the courts have almost uniformly said, there's just no right. Once you put your kid in the public school, it has to rise to some level of extreme indoctrination or coercion. And so that was one of the real barriers that we faced bringing this case. In fact, even kind of finding a split, there was the Eighth Circuit in one case has kind of given a nod to parents, but we were kind of dinged by opposing counsel for how thin that case was. And so that was a real hurdle for us. So to have the court kind of like reinvigorate Yoder and say, no, this is actually a free exercise case that is, the court said, broad applicability. That's super important, I think. Another one of the issues that I think is critical in this case is that the court recognized and reaffirmed that Yoder falls outside of the Smith rubric. And so normally under Smith, if you have a burden, you have to show not just that you're burdened, but also that burden is imposed by a law that's not neutral or generally applicable. And the court reiterated, said very clearly, you don't have to go down that route when you're bringing a right, a free exercise claim by parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children. So I think that's kind of the weakening of Smith and the broadening of cases that fall outside of Smith. Those are another interesting aspect, I guess, of it is the from a legal perspective is the decision in Barnett versus West Virginia School Board, which was actually brought on free exercise claims. But the court, you know, in a majority opinion, at least, kind of treats it like a free speech claim. There's been a lot of discussion over the intervening decades about what kind of case it is. And it's mostly been treated as a free speech claim. But the court reiterated today and treated as a free exercise precedent. So I think this case does a lot to really reinforce the free exercise right of parents to direct the religious upbringing of their children.
One of the questions, there's a lot to talk about, because of course you identified the key points that the dissent completely disagrees with. You know, they say that the majority has mischaracterized Yoder. They say that, you know, the West Virginia versus Barnett case is being ignored by the majority, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the points that I think all of our audience will perhaps be most interested in is the question that came up when we were talking about the rights of non-religious parents outside of this particular case. Did you see any language in the majority that would give comfort to those who either are atheist or agnostic and their objections perhaps are cultural or some other grounds?
Yeah, and I have to be honest, I haven't had a chance to scour the opinion as closely as I would like yet because of all the attention this case has gotten from the media. But I will say there is very strong language from Alito and the majority basically saying that this right of parents to direct the upbringing of their children is a core American right. It's part of our history and tradition. They really emphasize the importance of that right. And so I think that there's just a natural spillover effect to parents, even if their motivation isn't always based on religion. And just from a practical perspective, it's just hard to imagine that schools are going to allow opt-outs for the student. You know, these are primarily religious objections, but that they're not going to withhold them from parents who have non-religious objections, I don't think. But I think there's also, you know, this is a great springboard to kind of extend that protection more explicitly to go to courts. I just don't think there are very many courts that would somehow think that parents who are motivated by something other than a religious objection don't have that same right. So I think this is just, even if it's not as explicit as we would like, I think it goes a long way to protecting the rights of all parents.
And I think that's really important for particularly lawyers on this podcast, listening to this podcast, to understand so that if they have clients that come in with concerns that about a school board that has taken particularly aggressive positions like the school board in this case, but they don't happen to have a religious faith, that it's probably worth exploring what relief is available to those, even under this case.
Absolutely. And this is a slightly different issue, but somewhat related. I love in Thomas's concurrence, he makes a point of saying schools can't get around this issue by more seamlessly weaving this through their curriculum. Like, you know, here it was like in a pretty like it was these books were going to be taught in during English and language arts class during store hour. But he makes the point of saying, you know, you can't get around your right, your obligation to respect the rights of parents by just making it more difficult. And so I think, again, it just reinforces generally that the right of parents is very strong, and that's going to extend to protect people of all faiths or of no faith at all and in a lot of different contexts.
And I think that also was intended to sort of speak to the action of the school board when they had an explicit policy that things that turned on human sexuality, parents did have a right to opt out of, parents did have a right to notification. And so it seemed to me, as I read the briefing before the Supreme Court, that it really was intended to be just a sort of sleight of hand, a legal workaround, if you will, to do what they knew they couldn't do. And so I sort of read Thomas's concurrence more in that context. Like, come on, guys, we're all smart lawyers. We're not going to play this game. So.
Well, and yeah, and it wasn't even just like that there's this law that requires you to opt out of kind of this type of instruction on sexuality and human sexuality and family life. You know, before this case was brought, Montgomery County's policy was that students could opt out of any instruction that imposed a substantial burden on their religious beliefs. And that's really the policy of most schools around the country. And, you know, I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but like this kind of really cuts into the dissent's concern about this is totally inadministrable, will overwhelm schools. It's like, no, people have had these policies for a long time. Most parents, more than the school board, want their children to be broadly educated on a wide range of issues, to be aware of things even that they disagree with. And so they just don't run around making objections to every little thing. But this was an unusual case, unusually aggressive school board pushing an unusually ideological viewpoint under an unusually strict regime that didn't even allow parents to be notified about the books.
I was really surprised that the dissent talked about, you know, you couldn't, that part of the burden was that schools couldn't track attendance. And I thought most state funding of schools was based on attendance. So I'm a little confused by that.
You're actually pretty good at it. Yeah. Pretty motivated.
Anyway, so let's go back to the first couple of points you made about Yoder, because I do think a question that I walked away from reading the majority opinion with was that this Yoder exception to Smith. What are the contours of it? How do I know that this is a Yoder exception case? No, I'm still stuck with Smith. How do I distinguish those two?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, the court grappled just a little bit with that in a footnote where it said, you know, in Smith, this was referred to as a hybrid right, you know, which is well known from any lawyers who have been in this area. And courts, you know, some courts have been like, we're going to totally ignore this and act like it was never said because it's so incomprehensible. Others have tried to like make some sense of it, but it's been very controversial. And the court just said, we don't have to get into that because here you have the exact same burden that was imposed in Yoder. So the court didn't necessarily give us a lot of guidance, but it made clear that, you know, parents in the public schools, they have the right to withdraw their children from objectionable content. And I think it also just kind of raises the question of what is Smith's role at all? And what is the foundation behind Smith? If your free exercise right in this context is protected without having to show that the law was trying to target you or that it favors some people over others, why does the First Amendment not protect those rights in other contexts that aren't parental rights or whatever? So I think it actually just asks, it's hard to avoid the question even more now is like, why is Smith still there? And so this puts another chink, you know, in the wall and another, you know, if it's death by 1,000 cuts, where I think we're getting up to 1,000 by now, where it's time for the court to finally say like, look, Smith isn't really based on a solid foundation. It's atextual, as even Barrett said in Fulton. It's ahistorical. It's not consistent with how we understand these rights. And I think that the court was kind of giving a nod to that by reasserting Yoder as being outside of Smith and just raising the question, I think, implicitly, like, then what is the role? And the question you're asking, what is the role of Smith and why should it limit the right in other contexts?
But one of our listeners has raised the question, sort of a related question, my question about sort of what does Yoder stand for? They've asked, you know, how much of this is based on parental rights in a public education system, as opposed to say libraries and the content of libraries. Of course, we know there's the PICO case from the United States Supreme Court that talks about the withdrawal of materials and the censorship of materials in public libraries, et cetera. But how do you see this case? Is this case applicable in other contexts, such as the content of public libraries, the story hours that have been so controversial across the country? Do you see it having implications for that?
I mean, I think it would have application, for example, if you were required to go to, or there was a lot of pressure to go to public story hour and you couldn't leave if something was objectionable. So this was certainly defend, but that's usually not what happens, right? In story hour. So parents are choosing to go there. They can walk out at any time. So I'm not sure that the opinion, I don't think that the court is really saying that it's going to get into the business of what's in, you know, what schools put in their libraries or what other government authorities put in their libraries. I think this particular case is really about the right for people not to go to the library, not to or to opt out, use the library without having to use those books or things like that. So I don't see this as creating like a slippery slope that's going to create like really complicated problems about like the court getting involved in every decision about what books are put into the library. It does, I think, strengthen the obligation of schools to respect the right of parents if they don't want their kids to be exposed or they don't want their kids to be in the classroom instruction. I can see that it going a long way there.
In addition to the rather odd argument about taking attendance that was in the dissent, there was another argument that sort of seemed to validate what they described as the school board's concern that allowing children to not participate in these sorts of instructional activities would further the stigma and isolation of children who either believe they had same-sex attraction or believed that they themselves might have been born in the wrong body, those sorts of things. I don't see this case as, I'm not sure I think that's a valid concern, and B, I don't see this case as saying that people can be unkind or act inappropriately outside of the bounds of civility regardless. Are they answering a phantom problem?
There's so many things I could say about this, but I mean, that's one of the issues I wish that the message would get out more clearly that, you know, this was never about kindness and respect. Every parent in this case wants every child to be treated with kindness and respect. But we don't do that by forcing everybody to believe our view. You know, our parents weren't saying like we can only teach the things we think about marriage and sexuality in school. They're just saying like, okay, the ballot box, the parents voted for the county voted for these school board members. They've chosen this. Fine, we'll respect that. We just want to step out when it happens. And that's actually a higher form of kindness and respect. It's not true kindness and respect to say you disagree with me, therefore I'm going to force you to believe what I believe. True kindness and respect says, hey, I may disagree with you about things that are so important to me. They go to my most core fundamental beliefs. And yet I'm still going to see you as a human being and treat you with kindness and not try to force you to accept my perspective on the world. That's true kindness and respect. And I wish that that message would get out more clearly.
Did you do you think this case has any impact on school choice? Would parents have a right to vouchers since they're denied access to a public benefit due to their religious obligation to educate the faith?
That's a great question, maybe beyond the scope of my expertise, but I do think it says, yes, the right to educate is so important that even when you choose public school, then you have rights there. And it does suggest that if the school becomes so restrictive, you know, they choose to become so ideological that there are large numbers of people who can't be accommodated, that schools are going to have to find a solution to make sure that children can receive an education that doesn't violate their religious beliefs. So, you know, I hope that it won't go that far. I hope that I'm taking no position on the school choice issues, but just in the sense that I hope that school boards, the lesson they'll take from this is like, look, our responsibility is not to push our ideological viewpoint. It's to meet the needs of parents. And we're willing to do whatever it takes to meet individual needs. And in fact, most schools do an exceptional job at that. We have special programs for kids who need English as a second language. We have special programs for kids who have learning disabilities or other challenges where they are allowed to, you know, opt in and out of mainstream classrooms to get special, have their special needs met. This is a very small ask on top of all of that to say, also respect people's religious needs. And if you introduce a curriculum that offends a huge percentage of your parents, maybe the lesson the school board takes from this is like, hey, we're not actually meeting our obligation to serve students and parents, and we should focus on that instead of our own ideology. You know, Justice Sotomayor starts her dissent out with something about schools are like the most pervasive means of promoting our common destiny. And I think that just reads wrong. Certainly there are common things we want people to learn. But even on issues of like national security, right, about like our national values in Barnett, the court said, no, we're not going to force you. And we don't, the idea that our schools are an instrument to enforce conformity, I think is actually very contrary to the spirit of the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment in particular. And it's scary when the government starts to see the schools, its schools, as an instrument for enforcing ideological conformity. And school boards really need to abandon that idea and recognize that their job is to serve parents and help parents give their children an education that will allow them to be successful in the world without trying to create a national viewpoint on such sensitive issues.
Do you think it's the nature of the issues, though? Because Justice Sotomayor did appropriately quote the language in Barnett that said that the holding that the Jehovah's Witness children did not have to salute the flag did not mean that schools could not have classroom flag salutes. And that as long as the children that were had parents that were Jehovah's Witness or were themselves Jehovah's Witness simply could be exempted from the swearing or the upholding of the flag salute. Do you think that's not, this is different. We're saying that the kids don't have to be present. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I actually think it's very similar because I suppose we're not saying that. The court said, I guess, that there are limits, right? It said it's going to look at age. It's going to look at, like, what's the intent of the school? Is it teaching from a position of hostility or ideological conformity, or is it trying to teach neutral principles? So there will be a balance. There could be cases where parents lose on this going forward, but this case was far from that. But I still think it's an important lesson for the board to recognize that their goal isn't to push their own ideology, what they think is best for students. They should be thinking about how they can serve the needs of parents.
I did notice, and I thought it was important that you made the case, both in the oral argument, in the briefing, and from the lower court forward, that in this case, the school board actually had some instructions to teachers that they were to reprimand students when they gave a politically incorrect answer to some of the questions that they were using these materials to pose. Do you think, how central is that to the court's holding?
I think it was really critical. I mean, I was asked earlier, like on another outlet, like what I thought the most persuasive arguments were. And I said, it's actually the curriculum itself was the most persuasive argument, because you can try to spin it one way or another. And there are places where the board tries to say things like, oh, we would never force anyone to change their views. And yet in the very next sentence, it's like, you know, kids need to learn that, you know, doctors guessed at their sex and they should decide for themselves who they are. So there was, and I think Justice Alito makes a very strong showing of how these books were definitely pushing an ideology. I think the most damning fact for the school board was that their own principals came out and said, these books are age inappropriate. They're dismissive of people who have religious beliefs. They're shaming towards students and their religious beliefs. And so when your own principals and teachers are saying, hey, this is not right. These aren't, and they even said, this is presenting things as fact that aren't fact. And so the school board didn't really have a leg to stand on. So the idea that this was about kindness, or that it was just kind of normal instruction about, you know, family life or sexuality. No other school board in the country is pushing something so extreme and cutting off parents' notice and opt-outs. Everywhere in the country, you have opt-out rights, and hardly any schools are really pushing this kind of like direct instruction on such an extreme ideology where kids are said, you know, sex is unrelated to your birth, how you were born. You should choose for yourself which bathrooms you want to use. Disconnecting pronouns, even from gender, saying that your genders can change based on how you feel multiple times a day. I mean, some of this instruction is so confusing and so extreme, but I think that was one of the strongest arguments in our favor.
One of our listeners or viewers asked the question, do you think that this will extend to lessons with parents who want to opt their children out of, say, evolution on religious grounds, or the parents that said, the case where the parents said they didn't want their children learning that women had accomplishments outside of the home?
Yeah, I think that the court, I mean, I think the court, like the court said, these would all be very fact sensitive, and, you know, maybe there are times when the school board could make its case, and this just definitely wasn't one of them. As like the issue of evolution, I always think it's funny that one gets brought up, because you ask an average American, they don't really know that much about evolution. You know, most of us didn't. I never had an in-depth course on evolution in high school. You know, we don't force every student to take calculus. There are some things that just aren't really essential to being a good citizen. You can, you know, some people are just really bad at, don't love math or whatever. What would lawyers do if we all had to take calculus in high school? It just seems like we could have just a more common sense approach. These opt-outs have been permitted and are permitted today in schools across the country. And you don't have a lot of parents asking for opt-outs from things like that. And the fact that the school board sees parents in that light as ideological extremists who are going to like insist on the slightest thing is just, it's not very respectful towards parents. And really, ultimately, the question is the First Amendment there to protect the right of schools to teach what they want? Or is it there to protect the right of parents to direct their children according to their own upbringing? If there are some extreme cases that the court doesn't accept, or we let a few extreme parents do something that we disagree with, you know, sometimes that's the cost of freedom. But most parents are want more than the school board. They want their children to receive a broad education that prepares them to live and work in the real world. So all these extreme examples, I just think don't fly.
Another Professor Frank Beckwith, who many of our listeners may be familiar with his work on religious liberty as well, has asked about how Alito and Thomas discussed the fact that the rights of parents to direct their children is an unenumerated right. And when I teach constitutional litigation, I talk about the fact that there, certainly pre-Dobbs, there's a difference between the historical foundation for the rights of parents to direct the upbringing of their children and the rights of physicians to perform abortions. There's simply a difference historically. Are you thinking that they've done an adequate job distinguishing those sorts of unenumerated rights that are purely a product of judicial creation and those that are appropriately within the context of our understanding of the Constitution?
Yeah, a couple of answers. One, I mean, in the first place, I don't really throw this into the unenumerated rights category because the free exercise of religion is an enumerated right. And when you're, and it's just a subset of that is choosing which church you go to, choosing how to teach your children issues that impact their religious upbringing. So I think that's an enumerated right. There was also, though, and I don't think that the court got into this. I'd have to go back and look and see if there was much discussion of it. But just historically, if we're thinking about a due process right or the right of parents who aren't religious, historically, the right of parents to direct the education of their children is one of the most absolute rights. Some scholars have referred to it as a right that was absolute against the world, that almost to an a strong degree, parents had the say in how they educated their children, where they went. And that persisted through, through today, but before, until the formation of the public school system, that was very strong. The parents basically had to decide for themselves how they would control direct their children's education. So, you know, I think that's going to have to be something that's dealt with in another case and a substantive due process argument where there, maybe the parents don't have a religious right. But I do think that the history is very strong in supporting this particular piece of the larger picture.
I think that's right. I think of the case of J.R. versus Parham, or Parham versus J.R. I know I always refer to the parties sometimes when I'm thinking about it and not looking at it. But of course, that was the case where the court said that parents have the right to direct the medical care of their child, where the child needed residential psychiatric care. And so I don't know that this case has any direct relevance should that challenge come up again in a different context, in the medical context per se. Certainly it has some helpful language, but I don't think it has direct relevance. Lee McGrath asked the question, does the degree of the extremism of the facts limit the case beyond this particular school district? You've talked about most schools have opt-outs anyway. Most schools allow parents to have this sort of significant say. So it's a great victory. The language is helpful. But what's the real world impact?
Yeah, I think the balance of Yoder and Mahmoud makes clear that this is a broad right, and the court talks about it as a broadly applicable right. You think about the context in Yoder, these were high school students who presumably had more maturity, more capacity to kind of process difficult things. And there the Amish had no problem with their kids being in public school during elementary school. But when they got to high school, they were more concerned about the pressures of competition, careerism, kind of going out into the world and being your own person. Those were the values that were conflicted with their desire to have their children enter the religious community, learn vocational skills that would allow them to support the religious community. And the court reinforces that right in Mahmud. And so when they talk about things like age and the intent of teachers and things like that, that's got to be balanced with the fact that it can be every age, it can be every context. It just depends really on the religious belief. And, you know, there could be some other factors that come in there, but I do think it's a broad right. And you also, I think, you know, the court will also be looking at kind of like historically what's been allowed and what's possible. And the fact, especially on the issue of sexuality and gender identity, the fact that schools everywhere allow opt-outs from any instruction on that topic. You can opt out entirely of sex education. Again, it goes to this idea that the state's interest is in helping students learn how to read, write, reason, become productive citizens. It's not an interest in making sure that every student knows certain things or adopts certain ideologies. And so I just think in general, these cases will speak for themselves and create a broad right.
You think, Tom Palmer asks, are there implications from this case that will strengthen cases to limit athletic activities by girls to biological girls? I'm not sure I see that, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure it extends that far. Again, I think this is really focused on the right of parents to choose, make opt-out decisions, and to control what their children are exposed to. And so... You know, I think other cases will deal with these other difficult issues, but it does really enforce the role of parents, and hopefully that will embolden parents to speak out more, to be more involved. That's just another great lesson from this case. You know, you had hundreds of parents who protested. You had more who were concerned but were afraid that if they, you know, said something, they could lose their job, their children might be affected. And then you had, you know, a small number who are willing to kind of like be the face of the case. And each of them, I respect the decisions they made, and I'm grateful for their participation. But I hope that other parents will see that, like, hey, you can have an impact by getting more involved, being a voice. You know, our clients didn't think that by being willing to stand up and go to court, that they would end up in the Supreme Court 3 years later and have a victory that, you know, law students will be reading for decades. So you can have an impact. And I hope that's an important lesson that people will take from the case as well.
Were you surprised that the court didn't? I know when we talked after the oral argument, both of us had some concern that they were going to take the masterpiece cake exit off ramp, if you will, because the board did act badly toward parents that were presenting challenges in the board meetings, et cetera. Were you surprised that they avoided that off ramp?
Yeah, there was a fear, you know, at some point in the last month, you know, we kind of do these calculations about what's known about how the court assigns cases to different justices, kind of the effort that's made to have everybody has kind of an equal assignment over the course of a month, and seeing kind of who was writing when. When I started, I kind of got in my head like, this looks like something that Alito might write, you know, I thought. That gave me more hope that we would get the Yoder opinion. I just thought, I think he is, and generally the tenor of the court was, I think they want to reinforce the right of parents, and that's going to be best done through Yoder and not through Smith. So definitely was, and that was one of my big concerns going in this morning, is are they going to give us a narrow win by saying, well, this was not a neutral or generally applicable policy, or the board was particularly hostile in this case, because those are things that the board could go back and fix and try to redo, and we could just be back in the same position. And I think the court probably knew that. And I think they also took a little bit of offense that Yoder has been treated so poorly by the courts of appeals, that have almost uniformly said, this only applied to the Amish. It was an Amish one-off. It's one of a kind, sua sponte. You know, there's these different phrases that courts have used. And they did kind of go back and say, hey, no, Yoder is an important part of our jurisprudence. And so I think, you know, that was just great. When I saw that it was under Yoder, that was probably the sweetest moment today.
Well, you talked about how important it is that parents are willing to be the public face of a lawsuit, are willing to say this ends here sort of thing. Michael Blissenbach makes the point that it's that the coalition, as you've mentioned, encompassed Muslims and Catholics and Orthodox Christians. And so if the coalition had been less ecumenical, and I know that Beckett does a wonderful job of representing all religious faiths in the court, but if it had been less ecumenical, do you think the court would have been willing to take it?
You know, it's a good question. There was, I've pondered, like, did they take this for the split, which was actually a difficult split to identify because, like I said, almost every court has ruled against Yoder interests. There's an Eighth Circuit case that we relied on for the other side of the split. Or was this, you know, a couple of commentators have said, oh, the court took this as part of its outrage docket, which would suggest that kind of the extremity of the facts. I really do think that the biggest factor was Yoder. That I think this court would have wanted to reinforce Yoder, seeing that Yoder has been basically sidelined. I think that was probably the biggest factor in the court deciding to take the case, that it was an opportunity to reinforce that right. Did it help that we had a very broad coalition? Absolutely. I'm sure it did. But I think that they would have been happy to take it in another context. But, you know, again, the facts of this case do speak to, like, and there was a lot of questions from the court, like, how did Montgomery County let this go this far? Is this really the hill they want to die on? The Washington Post came out and said, really, Montgomery County, it was so easy just to accommodate these. So certainly that may have been part of the factor, but, whatever was the initial motivation, it became an excellent vehicle for the court to reinforce this right that's important to so many Americans, that they can send their children to public school and know that they still have a say in what's taught there.
I was really pleased and somewhat surprised, but during oral argument, of course, Justice Sotomayor, I believe, was the one who suggested, well, aren't these parents able to take their children to private schools or something to that effect? And the majority of Justice Thomas both were not having it. It's just like, this is not an adequate response.
You know, Montgomery County is one of the most diverse counties in America, both religiously and otherwise. A huge, large immigrant population, people trying to make a better life for their families. And so many of them are, you know, it's really hard to make ends meet, working multiple jobs. And so to have a school system that totally disrespects your views was really troubling to some of them. You know, some of them came to me and said, look, we came to this country to avoid this kind of stuff. It's shocking to us that we're experiencing this here. And for most of them, there's no way they could afford to keep a parent home, to homeschool, or to send their children to private school. And so this was a really critical decision for them to be able to continue to participate. You know, a lot of parents actually withdrew their children. One of our clients, they moved in with the grandparents in order to be able to send their kids to a private school. Others are, you know, one of our clients gave up her full-time job to, you know, to be homeschooling. So these are real sacrifices, and it shows both the sincerity of their beliefs and just the importance of making sure that when we offer public services, that we really try to make them as broadly available as possible without putting people in the position of being pressured to abandon their religious convictions.
Well, and we've had a couple of listeners that have raised sort of the, what's the implications of this for the school choice argument? It seems to me if the court had ruled any other way, then there would be a really interesting question that, okay, if schools can do this, then doesn't the polity have an obligation to offer alternative schools in this instance? They chose not to take that path, which I think is correct. I think it's the correct constitutional interpretation. But to the extent there are implications for the school choice movement, I think they're more political than constitutional in this instance, as long as the public schools have sufficient respect for the parents, and that is not adequately answered, as the majority tells us today, by simply saying, well, you've got to vote for your school board. Well, maybe I do, but that's not
You know, this, and we didn't take this position. Like I said, you know, we were really focused on the free exercise right. But for those who are interested, Philip Hamburger does have an interesting article where he talks about the free speech right to have an education that meets your children's needs. And the idea that when you're, because school choice is almost obligatory, mandatory for most people, that it's the governments have an obligation to kind of make sure that it's an education that doesn't violate their religious beliefs. So that's an interesting argument. Like I said, I'm not endorsing or unendorsing it, but for those who are interested in that issue, I think Philip Hamburger has some interesting thoughts on it that are worth considering.
Well, and I think there's another group of parents for whom that is especially true, is parents who have children with significant disabilities, because so often the conditions that are put upon the availability of those special services they need with private schools are contrary to the religious views of the schools. And so there's a whole, you know, that interface where parents of children with special needs often feel there is, even if they have the assets, there's really no choice except public school to get those services. So I think that's perhaps I see a congratulations to you for your significant victory, which of course we opened with. But I see no other questions in the queue except one that I think is to sort of close on, which is what are the next steps in this case now that SCOTUS has decided and remanded the case? What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, one of the things that's surprising to some people, probably less so to lawyers, but even we can forget sometimes after 3 years of litigating this issue, that this was all about a preliminary injunction. We were asking the court to protect parents' rights while the lawsuit is pending. So technically, of course, we're headed back down to the district court where, you know, there's the possibility of discovery. It would make no sense in this case to do that, of course, because the Supreme Court's opinion is, you know, we already had a lot of the documents from the school board about what they wanted to do, what they wanted taught. Then the courts addressed those. There's nothing new that's going to come out in discovery that's going to change the outcome of this case for the school board. So our hope, of course, is the school board will agree to enter into a stipulated order, protecting the right of parents, guaranteeing them notice and opt-outs. And even more broadly, I hope that the school board will reinstate its general policy that students can opt out of instruction that violates their religious beliefs. So that's what the next steps are. We'll be back in the lower courts, kind of figuring out how to resolve this case and wrap loose ends up.
Well, I see no other open questions. I know we've got a little more time left. Are there any final points you'd like to make about it?
You know, I think that maybe I mentioned this earlier, but one of the great things about this decision is the support it provides for living in a pluralistic society. One of the challenges we're facing in America generally is this idea that we can disagree about very important things and still be friends. And so this case is a reminder that the point of American freedom isn't, and democracy isn't to force other people to agree with us, but to learn to get along even when we have core disagreements. And this case shows an excellent example of how to balance those things. You know, Montgomery County residents chose through the ballot box to put the people on the board who are there and to make these kinds of decisions. And yet we can also respect the right of parents who disagree to have opt-outs, and those things can work side by side. And it's really what makes our system of government function. Yes, there is democratic decision-making, but they also have a Bill of Rights that balances out protection for core rights of those who end up in the minority. And so to me, this is a great civics lesson for students everywhere and an opportunity to kind of look for ways to live side by side even when we disagree on really important issues.
Well, I think, Matthew Arnold has one final question. Is there an establishment argument against ideological school boards imposing what amounts to a religion or cult view? I know that there are lower court cases where the claim has been made that secularism had become the state religion and was being imposed through various curriculum, and they did not bode very well. They did not fare very well with the courts. Do you see that?
Well, I think a couple of questions in there. One is like, what is the definition of religion? And I think we want to be careful that we make sure that religion is, you know, we at the Beckett Fund generally take the view that religion requires a belief in a superior being, that people, there's some kind of a belief in a higher power, which is what removes these questions from the democratic framework, that when you're answering a call to God, that's something that can't just be reasoned between individuals and compromised. So that's one question. The other is kind of like, you know, I think on the Establishment Clause, the Supreme Court is moving towards a better view of this Establishment Clause, a historical view that the founders had very specific things in mind when they talked about an establishment. And those things were, you know, forcing people to participate in church worship or ritual, punishing them if they didn't, you know, those types of things. And so I don't think they're going to kind of start, you know, going back to this idea that like just exposure to the religion is a violation of the Establishment Clause or maybe free exercise interests. But I don't think that we want an Establishment Clause that, first of all, suggests that everything is religion, or that suggests that the Establishment Clause bars kind of religious exercise beyond these very core things, bars, I guess, the reflection of religion in the public square beyond those very specific things that the founders thought were coercive against Americans.
And I think part of the confusion around that to some extent was that, at least among my students, and perhaps not to the people listening or viewing this podcast, was they think about the Seeger case with the draft. But of course, that was a statutory case. That was not a free exercise case. And that may be one solution for the objections of parents beyond the ballot box, that if there are other values that are comparable to religion but are not religious in nature, that at one level, I guess it sounds like I'm saying, so go to the ballot box and get something passed by your state representative. Well,
there is some point where that is the reality of living right in community, is that there are some things that will be decided by the ballot box and some things that where you fall in the minority. And that was the genius of the Bill of Rights, is trying to identify really core rights that shouldn't have to be compromised. And hopefully the other things were on the other side. We, because of the core things that are protected, we can get by in society, even if we don't agree with the values around us. But it also speaks, I think, to the importance like other social structures, churches, civic organizations, to kind of actively be involved in creating, you know, what Justice Kagan and Justice Alito in Trinity Lutheran called, you know, buffers against the government, that we have community structures that are built out to kind of help people meet their unique needs, even if they're not always in the majority or on the winning side in the ballot box.
Well, and I'd like to give a shout out, if permissible, to my colleague Tom Berg, who has just published a book saying that religious liberty actually is a safety valve in many ways for a diverse society, that respect for religious liberty allows us to live more harmoniously together rather than being the cause of the great culture civil war that so many people see, that when we respect the deeply held views of people about their eternal futures, that we actually lower the pressure and the sort of society we have. And as you were talking about this particular county that has the most diverse religious, or has a demography of a huge amount of diversity in the school system, that the more we try to compel one belief over the other, the more difficult it becomes to...
Right. That, I think, was motivating, yeah, philosophy behind the First Amendment, that the founders had seen a history of trying to coerce people to against their religious views, and it creates social discord and discontent. And I really like that safety valve imagery.
Right. Eric, this is a wonderful victory for all American parents. It's a victory for the ability of all Americans to have their children their children respected, as well as the parents' rights respected. And so congratulations to Beckett, and congratulations to you again. I'm insanely jealous that you have a big win with your first oral argument in front of the Supreme Court. And is there anything on tap that we should be watching for?
Oh, that's a great question. There are a lot of church autonomy issues, the right of churches to employ individuals who conform to their faith that are being challenged in states. Maryland, again, just Supreme Court just ruled that like churches can't require their own employees to be members of the church, which affects a large number of churches. I think there's a lot of issues around church autonomy that are have kind of been assumed, and we've kind of lived under them and assumed that churches have autonomy to do certain things that are now being questioned and challenged, and the court hasn't actually ruled on them. So that's an issue I think that people should be interested in and watching, is just how the court's going to deal with some of these church autonomy cases that are coming up.
Well, we're getting close to our time, but I can't resist this anonymous question that just came in. The live feed on SCOTUS blog speculates that this case will lead to requests for accommodation from Satanists. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I'm not sure what they want to be opted out of. So, you know, I don't think there's a lot of... I'm not sure what a Satanist would object to in the public schools, to be honest. So I don't know.
Perhaps something about Renaissance art or about geography of the Vatican. But I will say that we do that at one level. We're sort of talking about it as if it's silly. I have a young friend who actually in Oklahoma City they were supposed to have a black mass, and they had taken a consecrated Eucharist. And he, I thought, brilliantly used property law to say that it was unlawfully taken and it had to be returned to the church. And that was the end of the problem.
Well, and I think also, like, you know, a lot of Satanists, at least publicly, when you ask them or press them, they say they don't believe in any superior beings. Like their real philosophy is one of secularism and rational thinking. And so there's questions about, is that a sincere, you know, that's not a religion, or it may not be sincere. So I think there's just a lot of, around Satanism, there's a lot of things that, you know, just, I don't think the courts have really addressed yet, but there are other issues with those types of claims.
Which returns us to the fact that the court is moving toward more clarity about the definition of religion, but we're not there yet. Right. So,
yep.
All right.
Hopefully.
Well, I think we have responded to all of the questions. There are many notes of congratulations to you. And I'm very grateful for all the people that took an hour out of their day to listen to this conversation. I'm grateful that, Eric, you gave us an hour on a day when I know that you have 18,000 emails and phone calls from various other groups that want to hear your thoughts and your views on this. And I'm grateful for the Federalist Society for sponsoring this for us. So with
thank
that,
you, Teresa, for your great questions. Yeah, pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.